Hello and welcome to the second in a series of podcasts giving you an inside view of our catalogue of releases. On this podcast, we'll be focusing on our 2011 release, A Tower of Silence. My name is Robert James Moulding, just joining me this evening to my left.
My name's Dean Benison and I play guitar on the album.
I'm David Eaton, I play keyboards and some guitar.
Furthermore, in the circle of left, I'm Doug Skeen, I play guitar on this album, like I happen to do with the other albums as well.
Unfortunately, Anton and Steve aren't with us this time, but you'll catch up with them later, I'm sure. Right, start from the start. This album came about as an idea whilst we went 2 to 3 times around recording our first record, 23503. And by the time we'd finished the initial tracking of the second time, me and David already started speaking about what we wanted to do as a second album. And we wanted to do another concept.
I got it in my head that I wanted to do a ghost story. And to be honest, it was not a very fully formed idea. It was something...
To be honest, you'd just been banging on about doing a ghost story for ages because you like that sort of thing.
That's probably very true. Rob and I had just quit the job that we had done together when we were making the first album. And we both had about 6 months off work. And that was really the time that Rob emerged as a songwriter in his own right. He sort of spent a lot of time independently coming up with bits and pieces, and funnily enough, whereas I did a lot of the initial idea creation for the first album and sort of then collaborated with Rob, Tower of Silence was really the opposite way around. Rob did a lot of the initial germination of stuff, and then I sort of edited things or glued things together and help sort of take ideas further and change keys of bits and pieces. So, you know, it was sort of a bit of a role reversal on Tower of Silence. When we finished playing 23 live, and it was the six of us that were actually a band by that point,
We were a fully fledged band as a six-piece.
That's right. And Dean was in as a full member, and Nick was with us, and it was like we went back to the drawing boards, and we had this fantastic night out at Nick's place where we sort of sat down and discussed, because I don't think anybody in Anubis would agree on what they think religion is, but we all know what we think it's not, and we decided to have a very, very sort of strong dig at the idea of certain organised religions and the way that people are made to feel as a result of it, particularly things like original sin and, you know, a lot of the Catholic dogma and things like that. And that was something that was very much in Dean's ballpark, especially at the time. And so it sort of, we had this fantastic night at Nick's where the very sort of rough sketch of A Tower of Silence kind of got formed, and then Rob and I went away and wrote some sort of extra stuff, socio-political stuff with like the workhouse and the actual like vague sort of storyline before we sort of went to and back and forward between the band and everything for that to work. But it was a really, really nice germination on the concept for that one.
See, I don't seem to remember us being so in opposition of the ghost story, because I think we would have all had a bit of confidence that, given the elaborate nature of the story from the first album, you guys would have gone a bit beyond the average ghouls and goblins kind of story. I do remember you talking about the ghost stories even back before you guys had finished, so it must have been a lingering idea, maybe even before you even met me, possibly.
Oh, I think it probably was. Yeah.
I think I spent a lot of time taking the mick out of you for wanting to do a ghost story because I'm not a believer in ghosts. But of course, yeah, as soon as you start really discussing the idea, and even as a fiction, start talking about some idea of an afterlife, being from the kind of Douglas Adams school of raving atheism myself, you can. There's a lot of avenues that you can explore and that are worth delving into, you know, as soon as you accept that as the premise. So I'm the same as Doug. I was never opposed to the idea. I just like to take the piss out of you for it.
I think essentially we didn't want to take that as a vehicle, the idea of the supernatural, spirits and ghosts, but do you want to take it too far into the realms of fantasy and supernatural to the point where it got quite ridiculous? So bringing it to align with all our, our continued beliefs in religion and the afterlife. We managed to find a reality that somewhat exists using the supernatural.
We came up with the idea, I suppose, of using, again, our socio-political things, sort of a little bit more historically bent and everything, with the workhouse and everything. But I think A Tower of Silence, again, as a story, you can go two ways with it, because it can be very literal, and you can be like, oh, there's a story of a ghost, of a little girl in a workhouse, or you can actually look at the... And there really was an archway of tears in Birmingham. These places existed right across the UK. The poor law was disgusting. It was institutionalised cruelty based around as if it was compassion. It wasn't very compassionate at all. So we managed to, you know, inject some of our sort of soapbox leftyism into that record, as well as. Despite the fact that it is very, very critical of religion, the central character is not. So it misses that whole Richard Dawkins-esque cynical thing. The story is told through the eyes of somebody who really does believe in God. The beauty in that story is the fact that the little girl who's the protagonist she's just waiting to be, you know, to be absolved of whatever's keeping her locked to wherever she is, and she's just like absolutely raring to go, and it makes it really poignant and really, really sad, but at the same time, you know, really, really kind of aggressively anti the concept of religion without having to be preachy, cynical or zealous about. I think that's one of the reasons why people of faith are not offended by the record, because it's not meant to be offensive. And I think you can take it both ways, and you can either see it as being a very uplifting record. And I've spoken to people who've got very strongly held religious convictions that still think A Tower of Silence is a beautiful record. I've also met people who think it's an atheist manifesto, so.
For anyone unsure of the story of A Tower of Silence, please feel free to head over to our website. It's all listed there. You can read through the concept, gauge what the story is all about.
I never knew really how you guys went about doing the demos in such an intimate detail for the first album, but I remember that when we were going to do Tower, Rob had heaps of demos that he was doing in GarageBand. It's like small ideas, and I guess a lot of them ended up on being fleshed out more,
yeah,
and became songs on the album.
The major difference between the first record and the second record is not so much the writing process, creating demos, it was taking those demos into the room with a fully fledged band, six of us, all live, you know.
Yeah, the arrangement process was a lot more collaborative, and we got to...
and that sort of formed the music in a second form.
So yeah, it could
change and evolve, which was different from the first record. So it's where a lot of differences between the two records come into play. That and initially we wanted to change a lot of the palette, and a lot of the sound palette got changed purely by arranging in a room together. So
I think there's also the thing, and we've done this on every record, it's always, we've had like this sort of like reaction to the previous record, and 23 or 503, we used a lot of technology to try and get us over the line. Tower of Silence was really vibey and organic, and we did it all, like we did the arranging in a room, then we went and recorded it with like all the vintage instrument sounds and the amps and everything. It sounds amazing.
I think because the previous record, we were just getting an album together any way we knew how. Mm. You know, it was the first time you guys had worked together on creating a concept, writing all the music for it, and even the recording process, anything that we could do that was whatever, with whatever we had available, we would do that because we were still figuring out how we would make a record together, whereas now we had a proper band that had been playing live together and everything like that. I think the idea was that we capture not a bunch of musicians playing this music that we've written, it was capture this band playing this album. So we wanted to get the sound of that band, which means that everyone, you know, puts their gear in a room and plays the damn thing, you know, while it might not have all been tracked live with us all in the room, it was supposed to be tracked properly using our guitars and amps and sounds that we like, and you know, a bit more natural sort of a process.
It was a far more traditional approach to making the record. Mm. And I think that's one thing we wanted to do as another reaction to 23 was the six of us actually be, you know, in the same studio together as a band, because initially with the first record, we were sort of staggered and growing as member by member as the record evolved.
I think that was one of the nice things, though, is that even though that was the tiniest little control room in that studio we were in, that, you know, for most part, you know, five or six of us were in there while someone else was in the performance space, and we're all crammed in because we wanted to make a record together. That was the nicest bit about doing that record, I think.
It was a luscious smell.
Remember in terms of the stereotypical pressure of a second album to follow up on the first one. I don't remember feeling that, but Dean might have
different. I felt some pressure to follow up on it. I think, yeah, one, being a fully fledged member of the band, and two, I think, yeah, you know, it's not like we went multi-platinum or anything, but having had some level of success with the first album, I felt a bit of pressure in the producer's seat to make sure that this one came out sounding better than the previous one, and that it matched up to expectations, since the first one had done more than I expected. I remember trying to get the mixes right, and look, I've probably done it with every album since, but that was the first one I remember starting to tear my hair out trying to get the sound right, and to a point where I was happy with the mixes. And there was this really nice point after we just relocated the studio, and I was doing the mix out the back of that place for Holy Innocent, and finally had just figured out how to get the sound right for that album, just on the mix of that song, gave me the template to make the rest of it work. And suddenly I remember the weight kind of lifting off, thinking, oh, finally I figured out how to mix this effing record. Calling out my name with your words, I'm paralyzed.
think we'll go around the room and talk about our highlights on the record. And for me personally, I'll start with the opener, being the Passing Bell. The reason I enjoy that so much is because there are like four or five different bits and pieces, demos essentially, that made that song, that put it together, which I had most of them I did done myself, but I needed Dave help to sort of arrange the pieces together. That's essentially the mark of a good epic, I find, is if you can find lots of different bits and pieces and segments and manage to weave them together. And it starts the record in a strong way. It really does set down a marker of what the story's about, and the way it moves, so the way it evolves, and then obviously at the end, the way this whole song resolves by the end of the track, it's pretty stellar. And it's kind of been, in some ways, it's sort of set a benchmark for us, I believe, as far as writing an epic for an album. And it seems to be something where we have always wanted to do, is at least to have one rather long song on a record.
Definitely sticks out to me with that track, having one of Rob's finest vocal moments as well in the last movement before going into probably one of the most signature Dean Benison solos as well. It's got a lot of things Anubis is known for in that one track.
There's a lot that's a bit of a template for, you know, stuff that came afterwards. Some of the elements that go into arrangement, things that we've kind of repeated ourselves again, referring back to that way of doing things because it worked so well, I think.
I think it's very quintessentially Anubis track, to be honest. And the way it opens the record with the atmosphere, the Mellotron intro and stuff, and then there's the bit in the middle, some really good harmony parts, like the Where Did I Go Wrong bits come up, there's, you know, it all drops part back to that atmospheric stuff. And, you know, the Rag and Bone Man sound at the end and everything. It sort of captured the mood. It's a great opening track for a live set as well. We always seem to pick Passing Bell as an opener. It was a really good opener. Great opener on the European tour as well.
I was always surprised by how well that was received live. I remember first couple of times it was suggested as an opener, I was a bit against it, thinking, oh no, it's going to be a bit too long. And people loved it as
a big
opener.
Slab of music.
Always, yeah, it is. It's a lot to take in one go, but people have seemed to really respond to it as an opener. It's been really good. Archway of Tears, I think, is a bit hard to talk about because it's one of the shorter tracks that we've written-ish, I suppose.
Yeah.
And there's not... It's pretty straight up and down. It's easy to play. It's verse-chorus, don't bore us for the most part. And we're in danger of probably overstating that a little bit because I do think in the context of the record it's good. I'm still proud of the riff in the chorus.
I think the chorus is a lot of its saving grace because it's quite stomping, quite thumping as far as the chorus goes.
I think also because it is a bass driven song, and that although you wrote that riff on guitar, it was Nick's choice to do it on bass.
In drop A.
And obviously since Nick left the band, I mean, so we've only really done it with Anton once.
Considering how simple of a song it was though, it always kept me on my toes with having to play the middle guitar solo because it's kind of like one of the most complicated solos in one of the simplest songs we have, so it's beyond my money to try and nail the Holdsworth vibe at least I was trying to go for.
Simple, you, I can hardly breathe.
final resting place next, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure is.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's the most underrated track on this album. I reckon the chorus is a really strong hook, so I always like hearing it for that part there. And the verses have got a cool groove to them as well.
It's quite an important part of the story as well. It's when the leading character passes away, so it needed something of a strong moment in the record to sort of represent that.
Steve's really good on it. I love the verse groove, and there's no chords in that verse. It's just like drones, and there's weird drones. So it creates a sort of chord thing, but it's really the like sort of melodic thing with the guitar and the glockenspiel that gives you any sort of chord. Mm. So it's not like the keyboards. Like when I play that live, I'm literally just triggering a sample of some backwards guitar or something like that that Rob did on the original demo.
It's the first part Rob recorded guitar-wise for any of the albums, right?
Yeah, it was a really weird sort of layering on that one. It was a real interesting sort of co-write, because the verses were Rob's, the choruses were yours, the big Tom-led bits came from Steve with my chords on it, and then that ending part was something Rob and I just jammed out in my studio one day with him on bass and me on guitar, and it just kind of came about really organically. We just end up gluing all these bits together.
I think it was a song that definitely grew in the studio as well.
In the studio you've got a lot better opportunity to flesh out things like the end section and make those work. That kind of stuff is really hard to put together in a rehearsal room.
The music is really oppressive, and that it's got this really dark, kind of dense vibe, and it needed to have to match the lyrics.
Considering it's the turning point in the narrative where the main character has died, and I'm thinking about the ending section of music now, I'm terrified. I'm terrified about the afterlife.
Mind you, having said that it's very dark and it's oppressive, I do think that's the thing that we did a much better job of on this record than the previous one, and that I think 23, it's very dense all the way through. There's a lot that just keeps battering at you, and there's good reason for that. I think Tower is broken up a lot better, and you get a bit of a reprieve to take in those sections, you know. So you've got a song like that, yeah, that's very oppressive, and yeah, it's not too long until there's a bit of a change in mood, and you can, you know, I don't know, it seems to be segmented better and a lot easier to take in.
I believe, Dave, you initially started writing this piece, A Tower of Silence, the dead last? Was it the last song to make the record?
Not sure it was dead last, but it came relatively late in the day. I mean, I'd got a piano at home by this point, like an acoustic piano, and just sort of started noodling around on it and came up with those chords at the start. And it sort of just, it kind of triggered this direction with these sort of strange chords with wrong bass notes and all sorts of things. His working title was Tony Banks, for very good reason, because that's something I always loved about Genesis, was the fact that Tony Banks used really weird chords, and lots of them. And A Tower of Silence, as a song, really has that vibe to it. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to lie, it's certainly not the least derivative thing we've ever done. It does wear its influences quite heavily on its sleeve, musically speaking, and obviously the sound palettes with pianos, organs and mellotrons and chiming multiple 12-string guitars probably doesn't help that, you know. But what I loved about the song was it was one of the first things that Dougie and I ever, like, wrote musically together.
I seem to recall hearing the opening for The Passing Bell, where we heard that main melodic theme of the album, and there was another piece that was developed off that that Dave was working at the time, which I don't think ended up getting used, and me, I guess, trying to get my head around progressive rock in general at the time, because I still was much a newcomer to the genre, I was trying to apply that 12-string guitar sound and impart some of my musical taste onto the idea that Dave had there, in an attempt to kind of join more in the writing party, because at that point in time, Dave and Rob were the main songwriters, and I guess they still continue to be, but it was all of us getting in on the action.
Yeah, it was one of the first songs that I had nothing to do with, instrumentally speaking, which was a different approach. So it does generate, it can generate something completely different. So, and I believe it did.
It was a really interesting thing, actually, because when Dougie and I had finished the sort of demo for the music and everything, Rob was at my place and just sang over the top of it, and sang nonsense lyrics, you know, and they literally were nonsense lyrics, but pretty much had the melody completely intact, which meant I could put harmonies on. And then we got to the middle part, and Rob's nonsense lyrics were "lights that changed, light my way." It's exactly the same as what's on the album. When you put it into context, those lyrics, all of a sudden, they became something, they meant something. And we had Martin Cook play flute on it as well, which was really lovely. And Dean did some really different sort of layering techniques rather than playing chords.
The screwdriver guitar trick.
Please explain me.
That blew my mind. I was going to ask you about that, man, because when I first saw you do that, I couldn't compute it. I had no idea what was going on.
There's a particular screwdriver, and I'm sure I still have that one screwdriver that's in my toolbox. There's a particular texture to the metal of the screwdriver that, when rubbed sideways along the string, that actually works quite well, like a violin's bow. It's and so you can do some kind of weird atmospheric slide guitar type things. Just put a whole bunch of delay on it and rub that screwdriver on the strings, and it sounds great. And that's the sound on that one. And Dave keeps at me to make sure we keep doing more of that every time we record. But no, it's a good trick.
In the verses, it's the only guitar layer that's there, so it actually takes up quite a big part of the sound in it.
Well, I think because Dave's playing piano primarily right through all the verses there, which is, as much as it's a harmonic instrument with a strong attack, it's a very rhythmic instrument, whereas so often it's the other way around, where you've got a rhythm guitar chunking out the chords, and Dave's always filling in that big background wash that gives it that sort of third dimension. That's a kind of the role reversal. Something needs to fill that pad sound in behind everything to make it feel a bit three-dimensional, and that's what that guitar part does there.
One feature that we started doing more of and had the ability to do, considering there were six of us, is the vocal harmonies. And that neatly brings us to Weeping Willow, which we decided to take a drastic step away from the rest of the songs.
Weeping Willow was probably the first thing that was on was the first thing I wrote for Tower of Silence. Not first thing that was written, because that was you, but definitely the first thing that I wrote for the album. And it was all, because it was just a 12-string guitar thing, I really wanted to do something with the vocals and all these different textures. And it's always been one of these things that I'm really keen to feature, the different tone colours of the different voices in the band. And Weeping Willow was done in a very different way, because we were sort of each taking a line and singing in six part, which is something I think we've only done a couple of times in different places. And it was a sort of an experiment. And then you sung your own harmony in the verses as well, Robert, with the falsetto part, and blending your own falsetto harmonies with me singing your harmonies.
Well, I think that's what that song requires the most, is the intricacy of the actual harmonies.
Yeah, it's a really delicate little song as well.
in revisiting it, like harmonically, it's a pretty complicated song as well. There's some like chord moves I don't think we've done in a similar fashion since then as well. Like it's got a real dark, particular atmosphere about it that just suited Tower so well. And to make the vocals work in six part over that is like a challenge in itself.
It's a real outlier for us, that one. I don't think, yeah, you're right, there's nothing else like it.
And don't forget Dean's other guest appearance.
Yeah, well, that again, that's another one-off. I mean, Dean's playing clarinet on that track.
How did you come to play the clarinet on that track, Dean?
I can't remember whether it was my idea or Dave's idea to try it. I can't remember whose idea, but yeah, the actual lines were, I think, worked out in about 5 minutes before I actually tracked them, to just have a couple of quick plays through, find the notes on the clarinet, and basically once I'd found a part between the two verses, they're roughly the same parts played up the octave in the second verse, I think. They're very, very similar. But yeah, it was literally sort of figured out in about 5 minutes, then walked into the studio, played them and went, okay, well that works all right. Good, we'll keep it.
Yeah. I think it was one of those moments,
fairly spur of the moment,
where you're in the studio and you just, something just sort of comes to you and chuck it on, get in the booth, see if it works. There's a moment there for call and response as far as the melody goes. One that the fader doesn't disappear, or you don't press the delete button, essentially. So
yeah,
just a happy happy accident, I guess you'd say. Well, not even an accident, it was just a moment of inspiration that seems to stick. And Away From My World To End was a song that was one of the first demos that was put together, and it kind of stayed the same way in structure, very much it didn't change from the demo. Bringing it into the room, bringing it to Dave, bringing it to the rest of the guys, it managed to evolve, especially in the middle section, which I had no hand in. It was something that I think evolved out of playing. A lot of that had to do with Doug, the riff-driven section in the middle. But yeah, it's one that, it's just a song that was written around the same time as finishing 23, and it pretty much stayed as it was.
When I first heard it, I think it was a lot slower, but I wasn't that keen on it, and then I heard the chorus vocal, and the verse was sort of was quite different, but then when he got to the chorus, he got that, and I wait for my world to end. I'm like, oh no, this is good. And that stuck in my head, and we sped it up because the original was a lot slower, but the bass line was on it, the guitar hook was already on it, the melody was mostly there, and yeah, I mean that was almost, at the time, that was probably the closest thing to the solo right that you'd done, because it was really, really strong, and that, again, it was that chorus melody that dragged me in. And it's another one of those songs, and that became a really big live song for us. You know, other than just after The Second Hand came out, I mean, we've literally played that song in every single show we've done since about 2010. You know, it's been a really, really big song for us. It was always, like, good live. Lots of energy.
Probably one of the most accessible Anubis songs, even though it still had a lot of the hallmark ingredients in it. Like, there's a lot of great thematic bass playing in there, some cool guitar leads, some like almost semi-metal riffs after that middle section got changed a bit. And in what other genre can you say a song has a mellotron solo? I think that's how we at least refer to it in the band. Still
One of the questions we actually got for when we made these podcasts was, do any of us consider any songs a sort of quintessential Anubis song? And
that was from Stephen in Cambridge.
Stephen in Cambridge, thank you, Stephen. In all honesty, I think the best answer for that would be the Holy Innocent. I think that that's probably as close to quintessential Anubis as we've got. That song has got sections in 4, it's got sections in 9, it's got sections in 7, and you could blink and you miss it because it's done in such a subtle way.
It's Steve that ties all that timing change together, because when we play it together, either rehearsing or at a show or something, I never ever have a problem. I'm normally someone who has to really count timing changes, you know. I'm really counting the different timings in my head to make it work. That song, I never have to. And I think the mark of how well Steve does that is that if I actually sit just with a guitar without the rest of you guys playing, you know, and just playing the chords to that song, I always cock up the timing. Yeah, I always get it wrong if it's just me. However, as soon as Steve's playing that beat, it just feels natural, and I'm not even thinking about how I have to do it. It just works.
We settle into them as a groove. We stay in the odd meter for a long period of time, so it ends up becoming just as instinctual as playing like 4/4 or 6/8. We don't change times against every bar like some people like to do. I think that helps with it being less jarring as well. I'm same with Dean as well. That song, if I play it by myself, I probably stuff the timing up a lot. But when we're playing it all together, it just feels very natural. I don't even know offhand what time signatures it's in.
Yeah.
It just feels normal to play.
Well, I think that's one thing we always aim for, and especially that song, is for there to be just sort of a fluidity with the rhythm. So it's risky if you're going to sort of write as and join as many parts together in alternate time signatures, but it'll work once you get it right.
As a track, I mean, it's always had this... It was the first thing that I say, or Dean said earlier, about the first thing he mixed that felt like he got a direction for the album. It was probably one of the last tracks we recorded, and one of the last tracks to be completely finished, but... the bit that's where the piano solo cuts into the guitar solo is one of the very first things that Robert probably ever wrote, around the same time as some of the parts of the Passing Bell. I remember the first time I heard what became the verse with the sort of guitar arpeggio. Robert had already written the organ stuff, and it got these really weird haunting chords on it. And I had to go back and try and work out what these chords were. Probably most people who are listening to this podcast are fans of the band, probably found us because of that track. Because when we released it on Prog Magazine's CD cover, it literally sort of doubled, tripled the sales of Tower of Silence. It was really, really incredible, the effect it had. That sax solo, the minute we tracked it, I was like, that is just spine-tinglingly good. Martin's an amazing sax player.
I remember at the time when he recorded it, you know, talking about this with you, Dave, that one of the things that is sort of your responsibility when you're in the producer's chair on an album is that you're trying to extract a particular type of performance from the players on the album at different times. You know, there are times where you need a vocalist to give you, you know, more intensity on a particular part, or try singing a different way, or can you try a guitar part that's, you know, a little bit more aggressive, or you're trying to extract different things from different players sometimes to suit your vision of what that particular piece of music is going to sound like in the end. And then there are some times where you just put the player in the room, hit the red button, and you go, okay, that's it, just do what you do. And that was one of those times where you just said, you know, you heard Martin play for about 3 seconds and you just thought, okay, well, we're just gonna track this a few times and pick the best one, because you don't need to exalt anything from it. It was just perfect the way it was.
I'm massively fond of that song. I still think that's probably my favourite, or at least very, very high up the list of my favourite moments from our entire catalogue.
Mm. Since that moment of getting the mix right on that song to where I was happy with it, it's from that moment on, it stayed on my list of our favourite, you know, or my favourite of our material.
I find it, as a writer, it's quite an inspirational song to listen to, just the way that the melodies are written throughout the verses as well, because the chords, as Dave was mentioning, they're so angular and so strange, but somehow the melodies are like paint a straight line through it, and it feels very, very accessible and very memorable.
Mm.
And that's pretty hard to do. Like I think, like the rhythmic things we do in the song, it feels natural. The melodic choices are natural as well, even as crazy as it is, really.
I really agree with that. I think it's why it's one of my favourite. I'm not for a guy that plays in a prog band. I'm not your typical prog fan. I love prog music when there's an element to it that is accessible. It's got to have some way. There shouldn't be complexity for the sake of complexity. There's got to be an accessible way into it. And for me, that's the thing we got right on that song. It balances the complexities with accessibility, really great melodies, good harmonies, and all of those, you know, nicer elements that are easy to listen to allow you a good way into the deeper complexities of that track that are all there.
To round off the record, which, as a concept of the story, is quite bleak, the resolution, that there is no resolution, essentially. We needed a song that was sort of pinpointed that concept, but at the same time needed to find some sort of uplifting, happy-ish ending. That's where this song, all it is, we sort of chose that as a backing in order to sort of script out the end of the story, or the end of the protagonist, how she feels by the time the record's done. And it's still a song that is enjoyed by a lot of people, and we still get a lot of positive feedback from it. And I feel we did a good job using that song to finish the record.
It's one of those tracks that, again, is bits. The second part of the song was something that Rob wrote around the same time as the earliest parts of Holy Innocent and Passing Bell, and it was one of the first things that I'd heard of him. It wasn't a classic prog sort of thing, which is kind of the direction that I'd come from. Sort of Steve Reich-like guitar rhythmic thing going on. And I know when we came to record it, that's something that definitely pricked Dean's ears up. So the way that in the middle there, you got me and Doug playing in 7, Nick playing in 3, and Steve and Dean playing in 4. So you got these like, so three different concurrent time signatures, but then the parts Doug and I were playing in 7 were very different, obviously. And then you got Rob singing over the top. So all these parts, when heard in isolation, sound really, really weird. But when you blend them together, it created this lovely sort of effect. Again, very Steve Reich-like thing.
Well, it is, and it's kind of why I pricked up to it, because I've always loved the electric counterpoint Steve Reich stuff. The whole verses of that song have got no reverbs or anything. There's no reverb sends used or anything. Everything's absolutely dry when you've got all of those interwoven bits. It gets really hard to pick one from the other when they're not in a reverberant space. And then, of course, all the reverbs come back up to make it a bit more atmospheric in the choruses. So that was the idea.
The first part of that section, you've got that big insistence of dum, dum, which is, you know, sort of quite aggressive, with these really sort of, again, Rob chords over the top, with these sort of strange intervals, which again sort of informed the melody. It's another one of those things that just shouldn't work, but it does. Rob had come up with the intro as well. All of the keyboard parts, all of the chords. I replayed the piano, but the Mellotron parts on it is Rob's original parts that he come up with. The last part of the song was something that musically I wrote as an extension to what Rob had written. I wanted something that was very grandiose and very sweeping, because if we're going to go for the climax of the record, I wanted something suitably epic that got that sort of grand sweeping feel. And you know, those chords felt right, that little keyboard solo in it as well. We didn't play it much when we bought Tower of Silence out, but then when Hitchhiking came out, we brought it back to the set, and it's stayed there ever since, and it's just this really big part of the show for us. And you know, I'm really, really fond of that one.
So Jeff asked, wanted to know who played the guitar solo on All That Is and how they went about writing it.
Thank you, Jeff. That was played by me, Doug. It was meant to be an ode to Rothery, really. That was what I was going for at the time. Dave had showed me Marillion around the time I joined the band, and it was one of the prog guitarists that was really jumping out to me, and I wanted to go for something in that similar vein. Something that wasn't shreddy and too fast and just relied on being tasteful. And I think it was probably the first solo where I was really, really happy with my playing, at least at the writing phase. I remember demoing it out to the backing track I had received of how the song was recording so far. And I had this solo planned exactly note for note how I wanted to play it. And I remember there was one ascending line towards the end of the solo that took me probably about 30 takes to nail in the studio, which we have in painstaking video of me screaming, swearing, profanity flying, regressing into the state of a four-year-old.
I do remember when you did the demo for that, I remember Steve going, he's not changing it, is it? No, not changing it. Steve was absolutely adamant that that was not going to be changed, and he was ready for a fight if there was any suggestion that that solo was going to alter in any way. Let's multi-track all the voices, and on that track, I think Dean, Rob, Dougie and I are on it about probably six or seven times. Dean's wife's on it, Becky's on it, our friend Katrina's on it, obviously Steve and Nick double track, and that's a down low. And it's huge, the amount of voices we used on that thing. And you know, when that was all mixed together, it really did sound quite lovely. And it's just the same chords from that ending section, but it sort of gave it an almost sort of quasi-evangelical feel at the end that really did sort of suit the sort of concept. Really,
I think,
really,
yeah,
part of the gospel.
The idea was to sort of suit the theme of the whole story, essentially. So it was a great little tool to use, as well as being a lot of fun to sort of track and to stack up the layers and have them sort of one by one develop and grow bigger. So
if I remember correctly, I remember Steve and Nick and I doing a lot of the medium parts, like the baritone parts. You and Dean were doing tenor, and Becky, Kat and Dave on soprano. Dave taking the culture of art.
Yeah. Castrati.